Hello, and welcome to Science World. It's that time of the year again. This past week, the 2013 Nobel Prizes for Physiology or Medicine, Physics, and Chemistry were announced in Stockholm. Bob Doty tells us about this year's winners. Rising labor costs have led to incredible growth in manufacturing automation in China, which makes the country the biggest purchaser of robots. Bill Ide will have a report for us. Scientists met this week to discuss how some flooded crops like rice could stay alive for long periods of time. Simone Orendine tells us more. And scientists at Stanford University say the processes behind the formation and evolution of planet Earth are similar to those that allow water to trickle through coffee grinds to brew your morning coffee. We'll learn more about this a little later when we talk with the leader of the research team. This and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Scott Carpenter, one of the legendary seven original U.S. astronauts and the second American to orbit the Earth, has died after suffering a stroke. He was 88 years old. Carpenter flew into space aboard his Aurora 7 space capsule on May 24, 1962, and orbited the Earth three times. He also gave NASA its first major scare when technical problems and low fuel forced Carpenter to manually bring his space capsule back to Earth. Splashing down 465 kilometers off course, millions of television viewers held their breaths, wondering if Carpenter survived, before a Navy rescue crew found him. Carpenter never flew in space again, but did live on the Pacific Ocean floor for a month aboard the C-Lab capsule in 1965. The 2013 Nobel Prizes for Physiology or Medicine, Physics, and Chemistry were announced this past week in Stockholm. Science World's Bob Doty tells us more.
The Nobel Prize for Medicine has been won by two Americans and one German, who all work at U.S. universities. The winners were announced on Monday by the Secretary of the Nobel Committee for Physiology or Medicine, Göran Hansen.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institute has today decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine jointly to James Rothman, Randy Scheckman, and Thomas Sudhoff for their discoveries of machinery regulating vesicle traffic, a major transport system in our cells.
Medicine is the first of the prestigious Nobel Prizes awarded each year. Rothman is the chairman of the Department of Cell Biology at Yale. Scheckman is a professor in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology at the University of California at Berkeley. He is also an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Sudhoff is also an investigator at Howard Hughes, and he is a professor of molecular and cellular physiology at Stanford. The 2013 Nobel Prize for Physics has been won by two scientists who predicted the existence of the Higgs boson, the particle that is key to explaining why elementary matter has mass. Stefan Normark from the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences announced the winners Tuesday in Stockholm.
This year's prize is about something very small that makes all the difference. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Physics to Professor François Englert at Université Libre de Bruxelles, Belgique, and Professor Peter Higgs at University of Edinburgh, United Kingdom. And the Academy citation runs for the theoretical discovery of a mechanism that contributes to our understanding of the origin of mass of subatomic particles, and which recently was confirmed through the discovery of the predicted fundamental particle by the ATLAS and CMS experiments at CERN's Large Hadron Collider.
The two scientists are known for discovering the so-called Higgs particle, nicknamed the God particle, because it validates a very basic concept of particle physics, the so-called Higgs field, which is believed to make possible the existence of atoms themselves. And this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry has been awarded to scientists Martin Karplus, Michael Levitt, and Ari Varshall. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences permanent secretary, Stefan Normark, praised their work in development of multi-scale models of complex chemical systems.
This year's prize is about taking the chemical experiment to cyberspace. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Chemistry to Professor Martin Karplus at Université de Strasbourg, France, and Harvard University, Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA, and Professor Michael Levitt at Stanford University, School of Medicine, California, USA, and Professor Ari Warshall at University of Southern California, Los Angeles, USA. And the Academy citation runs for the development of multi-scale models for complex chemical systems.
The Academy said three U.S. scientists won the chemistry prize for laying the foundations for development of computers to understand complex chemical processes, from the purification of exhaust fumes to photosynthesis. The work helps in complex processes such as the development of drugs. The Nobel Prizes for Chemistry, Physics, and Medicine will be awarded on December 10th in a ceremony that will be held in Stockholm, Sweden. This is Bob Doty for Science World.
Rising labor costs in China have led to booming growth in automation for manufacturing, and that is turning the country into the world's biggest purchaser of robots. Bill Ide has the story.
Robots that can dance or play football may seem like just pure fun, but international companies based in Shanghai say the technology on display is no game. Robots have traditionally been used in heavy manufacturing, but their uses are widening as their capabilities expand and their costs come down. Shonren Mizutani is CEO of the Japanese robotics company Yaskawa. He says some robots are used to make iPhones and smartphones.
Assembly that used to be done by hundreds of thousands of people is now done by robots. The development of China's robotics industry over the past 20 years has been a long and difficult road, and it wasn't until more recently that the industry started developing more rapidly.
Yaskawa is one of several leading robotics manufacturers based in business-friendly Shanghai. Mizutani says that when his company started in China in 1996, they were only selling dozens of robots a year. Now that number is in the thousands. Last year, 23,000 units were sold in China, according to the International Federation of Robotics, which says the country is the most rapidly growing market in the world. Wang Zhiliang is with the University of Science and Technology in Beijing.
In 2013,
there was a rapid expansion in China's industrial robots market. This market now, for example, the Shenyang Automation Institute focuses solely on robotics in China. This year already has orders for robots until 2015. Why is that? Because the cost of China's labor force has increased immensely.
Foxconn, one of China's largest private employers, has set a goal of adding 1 million robots by next year. Mizutani says the trend is expanding even outside factory walls.
Right now, we have some robots that are used in hospitals that can help with joint recovery or perform small procedures. These are not factory robots. They're called service robots.
At Beijing's University of Science and Technology, Wang is developing robots that care for China's rising number of elderly. Robots can alert people to take medications, not walk too far, or remind them to go to sleep. But, says Wang, challenges remain.
For example, the elderly need to have water poured in a glass for them, so the challenge is pretty big still for a robot to go from one place to another and pick up the glass. Artificial intelligence technology is still the most difficult part.
So although these machines can assemble iPhones and weld car frames, some simple tasks, like fetching water, are the new frontier for China's robot workers. Bill Ide, VOA News, Shanghai.
It's time again for the Science World Quick Quiz. This week, a team of South African scientists reported that they found first evidence of a comet striking Earth. They say this comet shot into Earth's atmosphere and blew up above what is now known as Egypt some 28 million years ago. After conducting tests on a mysterious black pebble that had been found by an Egyptian geologist in 1996, the researchers concluded that it represented the very first known hand specimen of a comet nucleus. So far, the only other comet fragments that have been found are microscopic dust particles. Where were these tiny comet remnants found? A. In the upper atmosphere and in some Antarctic ice? B. At the bottom of the Pacific Ocean and the Gobi Desert? Or C. In Arctic ice chunks and in ice near the peak of Mount Everest? Think about it and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
While much has been done to immunize infants against polio, millions of people living with the disease are unable to live a normal life. One surgeon is working to change that. Aru Pandey has more.
At one of New Delhi's oldest hospitals, in the only designated polio ward in all of India, patients like Abida Khatun have only one goal.
I can stand and walk. I just need a little help, and soon I won't need that as well. Soon I'll be able to walk on my own.
It took 2 months of surgery and rehabilitation at St. Stephen's Hospital for Khatun to achieve her lifelong dream of being able to walk. She and other young women in this 8-bed ward credit Dr. Matthew Varghese, an orthopedic surgeon who has devoted his entire career to restoring mobility and dignity to those left crippled by the polio virus that invades the brain and spinal cord, causing paralysis.
Because all these girls have been crawling, except for this one. All the others have been crawling. The other muscles are very weak. They've never had the opportunity to stand on their 2 feet. For the first time in their lives, like this girl who's paralyzed at 6 months, she's never been able to stand on her 2 feet.
As India gets closer to officially being declared polio-free, the effect of the massive immunization effort can be seen in the hospital, with Dr. Varghese now mostly treating people in their early 20s as opposed to young children some 2 decades ago. In 1990, New Delhi alone saw 3,000 new polio cases. Now that number is zero. The trend is reflected here at this polio ward, where at its peak it saw 600 patients annually. Now that number is down to less than 200. Rotary International has been on the front line of India's polio eradication efforts and helps fund reconstructive surgeries at St. Stephen's. Former Rotary President Rajendra Sabu saw the need to give polio patients a second chance at a normal life during a trip to a village in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh.
Then another child came, also crawling. And I said, what is happening to these children? They seem to have been struck by polio. And the villagers, they said, No, just forget them. They are dust.
But Rotary and Dr. Varghese did not forget them. Patients hear about the ward and travel to New Delhi from across India in hopes of correcting bent legs and feet. No one is turned away. After weeks in the hospital, 19-year-old Abida Khatun is getting ready to go home to her village in Uttar Pradesh.
If I had only met Dr. Varghese earlier, I wouldn't have had as much hardship in my life. My hands wouldn't be so calloused. Because of him, I'm doing better.
Khatun is not the only one brought to tears. When asked what this surgeon's dream is, the answer was simple.
My dream, this ward should be empty. No polio.
Aru Pandey, VOA News, New Delhi.
Crop scientists from around the world met this past week in the Philippines and exchanged ideas on how flooded rice and other staple crops could stay alive for long periods. Simone Orendane has this report.
Scientists at the International Rice Research Institute, or IRI, have already found a way for several varieties of rice to live after being totally submerged for more than 10 days. About 5 years ago, farmers in the Philippines, Indonesia, and several South Asian countries started growing these palatable varieties that have been crossbred with the gene called SUB1, which stops the rice from growing while it is underwater to preserve itself. But still, IRI principal scientist Abdelbaghi Ismail says in Asia and Africa alone, close to 25 million hectares of rice is lost to floods every year. There are about 150 million hectares of rice worldwide. With 1/7 of the total crop lost, Ismail says researchers want to find a way to make flooded rice survive even longer. And so now they are looking closely at the work of researchers who study how plants survive without oxygen.
Now, sub-1 can protect up to 2 weeks, but sometimes you get floods up to 25 days. So we lose it, even with sub-1. So we want to see if you can increase flooding tolerance by more than 1 week, additional to sub-1. So any information that comes from these studies could help us.
Ismail says right now, Erie, whose work is heavily focused on how rice adapts to flooding, is concentrating on three areas. Scientists want to help inundated rice sprouts continue to grow normally, to look for other genes that also do what sub-1 does, and to breed varieties that can withstand total and partial submersion because of flooded soil that never completely drains during the rainy season. Researchers are still working to understand how plants are able to sense low oxygen levels, sending them into survival mode. Scientist Laurentius Vosnek of Utrecht University in the Netherlands researches wild plants that live in partial submersion or flood-prone river areas, focusing on fundamental traits that help plants cope with flooding. Vosnek's work is on ethylene, a gas emitted by plants once they become submerged.
Gases produced by the plant can only very slowly escape. So if production continues, it builds up. And that is a very reliable signal for the plant to know I'm underwater, I'm in trouble, I have to do something. Switch on genes which might protect.
Scientists are also sharing work on crops in stagnant flooding, which Ismail says is important to learning about what will help farmers use the wet soil of flooded rice fields for other staples such as maize, wheat, and barley. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Los Baños.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Well, let's find out. This week, a team of South African scientists said that they found the first sizable specimen of a comet's nucleus. So far, the only other comet fragments that have been found are microscopic dust particles. Where did scientists find these tiny comet remnants? A. In the upper atmosphere and in some Antarctic ice? B. At the bottom of the Pacific Ocean and the Gobi Desert? Or C, in Arctic ice chunks and near the peak of Mount Everest? Well, the answer is A. According to the scientists who reported the discovery this past week, research conducted by NASA and the European Space Agency found microscopic comet dust in the upper atmosphere and in samples of Antarctic ice. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Have you ever wondered how Earth was created and how it was able to evolve into the planet we call home? According to new research by scientists at Stanford University's School of Earth Sciences, the answer just might be as simple to understand as the process that allows water to trickle through coffee grinds to make your morning coffee. The Stanford team's findings backs up a theory proposed about a half century ago. That theory suggested Earth's iron-rich core and the layers that make up its internal structure might have formed in a series of steps that took place over millions of years under varying temperature and pressure conditions. The researchers were led by Dr. Wendy Mao from Stanford University and the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory, which is operated by the university. She joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about the creation and evolution of Earth and what her team's research has uncovered about the processes behind them. Dr. Mao, you recently led a research project that examined the creation and evolution of Earth's structure. Can you first explain to us, please, just how our home planet came to be?
Well, that's actually the big mystery. We don't really know. So we know the current structure in the planet that we have, a rocky upper and lower mantle, and it overlies this metallic core. So there's a really dramatic layering in the planet. But since no one was around 4.5 billion years ago, we don't know exactly how it came to have the current structure. And so that's what we've been studying, like different ways in which you could separate all this metal from rock.
Your team's research provided some evidence in support of a theory that was proposed 50 years ago. Can you please tell us about this theory and how your team's work supports the hypothesis?
The theory is called percolation. So one can imagine that one way to get the metal that forms the core, which is iron-rich, would be for a molten iron, so liquid iron, to actually flow between solid rock, so between the grains and solid rock. But previous measurements early on at lower pressures and temperatures showed that this was not possible, that the iron actually just forms isolated blobs. So the droplets wouldn't connect and be able to flow between the grains. But what our current research showed that at much higher pressures and temperatures, then actually the behavior of the iron changes. And so now the iron can form channels. And so it actually does connect and wet all of the rocky crystals. And so then percolation became a mechanism that can occur, but only at much higher pressures and temperatures.
On the other hand, while your work does support the theory, did you find anything that could disprove the theory?
Well, certainly at lower pressures and temperatures, what previous findings found were true. So it wouldn't work except at much higher pressures and temperatures. So only when our planet or only when our planet reached a certain size. So it had to get large enough before percolation could happen.
How did you and your team come up with the evidence that supports the theory? I'd like to know a little bit about your experimentation. What was behind it?
So the reason why this hadn't been tested before was because of the very high pressures and temperatures that you had to reach. So in order to overcome that kind of technical challenge, we compressed a small amount of iron and rock between the tips of two diamonds. So that's how we generated the very, very high pressures that actually mimic those existing inside the planet. And then we used lasers to heat the sample to very high temperatures. So since we're able to reach these very high pressures and temperature conditions, we're able to access kind of a new conditions that hadn't been looked at before. And it was only at these new conditions that you could see the iron forming these channels.
Is the internal structure of Earth final, or is it continuing to evolve billions of years after it was formed?
Well, the main structure is pretty stable, having this rocky mantle and metallic core. But the finer details are still changing. Like the solid inner core didn't exist when the Earth initially formed. The core was completely molten, but it's been crystallizing or solidifying over time. So slowly the inner core is freezing out and the outer liquid core is getting smaller and smaller. And then there are also some subtle chemical differences that are occurring. And then also at the surface, we have new crust forming and new crust being, and old crust being subducted. So there are some changes occurring, but the main change of the core versus the mantle, that's fixed.
You were mentioning a little bit about the structure of our planet, and you talk about layers. Now, the Earth is made up of various layers. What are they? Can you tell us about them?
So we live on actually the thinnest layer, which is called the crust. So this is a very, very thin layer of rocky material that's actually the melt product of the upper and lower mantle. So those are much thicker rocky layers. And then about midway down, if you were just to go from the surface down into the core, about midway during your travel, you'd then hit a very dramatic boundary that separates the lower mantle from the outer core, and the outer core is liquid iron. And then further down, you actually get into the inner core, which is solid iron. So those are the main layers, the crust, then the upper mantle, lower mantle, those three are all made of rocky materials, and then the outer core, inner core, which are both iron-rich metal.
That was Dr. Wendy Mao from California's Stanford University and the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory, located in Menlo Park, California. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.